Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiars. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University College of Arts and Sciences titled Henry David Thoreau's Legacy of Resistance and Hope. Our speaker is Laura Walls, professor of English at the University of Notre Dame. We begin with introductions by tonight's moderators, Boston University professor of English Adriana Krakun and professor of biology Richard Primack.
Laura Walls is the distinguished professor of English at the University of Notre Dame. I first became aware of her when she published an excellent biography of Alexander von Humboldt several years ago. This was a work which brought Humboldt back to the attention of the American public, who had forgotten him over the course of several centuries. This book, this biography of Humboldt, won two prizes, one from the Organization of American Historians and one from the Modern Language Association. And then in more recent years, Laura Walls published the first book in a generation to really portray Thoreau as a human being within his place and time, the historical and social context of his life. This book took Thoreau from being a kind of a caricature to being a vibrant person full of humor and life, addressing the issues of his time. Laura Walls has won many prizes during her career, but most notably the Guggenheim Award. This lecture is a very appropriate one for this audience because Thoreau really speaks to many areas of academic life and to American society. So particularly appeals to people in philosophy, people in English, political science, biology, and earth and the environment. So this is a very appropriate lecture for us today. And she's speaking today on the legacy of Thoreau in terms of resistance and hope. And now we have Adriana, who's going to be speaking a few more words.
Just to join in to say the fact that we have a professor of English and a professor of biology jointly hosting and introducing our speaker speaks to the unique value of her work as interdisciplinary practice. And the book on Humboldt called Passage to Cosmos really exemplifies the value of doing very innovative, genuinely interdisciplinary work. And many people can claim and talk about the value of doing it, but it's very hard to do to a high degree of excellence, as Laura has done. And that's why we're thrilled to have her here, because she doesn't just talk about doing that. She puts that into practice. She's at work, I know, on a new one of her many current projects, because she's incredibly prolific, is a new group biography of transcendentalism. And I know that will be hotly awaited by so many people working in many fields. And without further ado, I'm going to introduce Laura Walls.
So, coming to Walden. On July 5th, 1845, sitting at his desk on the shore of Walden Pond in a new house, still smelling of fresh-cut pine, Henry David Thoreau opened a new journal notebook, dipped his pen in fresh ink, and wrote, "Yesterday I came here to live," across the top of the manuscript page there. In time, he would look back on the 2 years, 2 months, and 2 days that he spent in this house as the climax of his life. But at this opening moment, his tone is a little uncertain. He writes, "If I'm not quite right here, at least I'm less wrong than before." This was all an experiment. His family was nervous but supportive. His friends were curious, expectant, and a little skeptical. Thoreau knew failure was not an option, but what shape success might take was still unclear. As he concludes on that first morning, "And let us see what they will have." Well, why was he there? "To write a book," answers his biographer, "a week on the Concord and Merrimack Rivers." He'd been planning it ever since the death of his beloved brother, John, nearly 4 years before. This book would be an elegy for this friend who'd been half himself and for the life that they had shared in a small boat the life that they'd shared. It would tell the story of the two-week river journey that they'd taken many summers before in a small boat that they had built together. And the river would run through its every page, bearing them as they rode upstream to the source and carrying them back down the stream of time to the end. Reliving these days would take Henry from that pine-scented house there at the pond all the way across the rupture caused by his brother's death, renewing the past so that Thoreau's life in the land through which he lived could once again come alive with meaning. In short, Thoreau was at the pond to mourn and to recover, to heal and to find hope once again. By the time he'd left the pond, he'd written his book. But on that first morning, he also opened a second book, Walden, where the first book would look back to the past. This one would look to the future. As he wrote, "And now, tonight, my flute has waked the echoes over that very water of Walden Pond. The pines still stand here, older than I. Or if some have fallen, I have cooked my supper with their stumps, and a new growth is rising all around, preparing another aspect for new infant eyes." He calls this future-oriented stance anticipation. As when he writes near the beginning of Walden, to anticipate not the sunrise and the dawn merely, but if possible, nature herself. Now, to anticipate combines the word ante, for before, with capere, to take or to contain. So it means not just to sit around and wait for a future that's just going to be more of the same, but something closer to the French word avenir, that is, à venir, or to come, what is to come, or the advent of something new, and hence a radical break with what is. In this sense of anticipation of the future, that is, of us, lies the key of Thoreau's meaning for us and his relevance for us today. So when Thoreau writes in his motto of Walden, of bragging like the Chanticleer to wake his neighbors up, he makes himself a watcher for the dawn, anticipating the emergence of something, a hope, a utopian possibility, perhaps, that lies dormant in the present, like the seed that's tucked away asleep in its hard casing, awaiting the spring when rainfall and sunrise will awaken it at last. Anticipation tells us that the signs are here now, visible in the present. But merely looking toward the dawn is not enough. One must act to make that dawn happen. So this is why Thoreau tells us a little mysteriously in Walden, "It is true I never assisted the sun materially in his rising, but doubt not it was of the last importance only to be present at it." Well, here, in his own act of anticipation, he's quietly dropping into the furrow of the page he's writing a little seed of thought that will spring open hundreds of pages later in his famous close, "Only that day dawns to which we are awake. There is more day to dawn. The sun is but a morning star." And I transcribe it in the bottom to emphasize in the actual manuscript, which is at the Huntington, he went back and wrote over to capitalize morning star and underscored it twice. So when you look at the manuscript, you get that sense of that final flourish. "It is of the last importance, thus, that we too be present at its rising." Well, Walden was but a morning book. There was, or there was supposed to have been, much more of Thoreau's day to dawn had he lived a normal lifespan. This is the burden of the books that he left in manuscript at his early death, Wild Fruits and the Dispersion of Seeds. In them, he gathered all the time that ever was and ever would be in the cycle of the seasons, dispersing the future into the wind and then regathering it into the fertile soil of possibility. Years after Thoreau left Walden, he discovered the writings of Alexander von Humboldt, who helped him turn in a new direction toward a forest-thinking version of Humboldt's cosmos. All life was enacting an evolutionary process rich with the utopian advent of newness, an evolution that was, as Thoreau said of Darwin's theory, not the unfolding of some predetermined fate, but a constant new creation, the constant regathering of all time into the seeds of possibility. Within the seed, then, is coiled the constant hope, but remember, the conditional hope, for like the rising of the sun, does it not depend on our being fully present? The constant and conditional hope of the coming of the spring. All this is to say that in a profound sense, Walden was intended to be a religious book. Thoreau understood this from his very first days at the pond. He wrote that it was time for the written word, the scripture, to be heard. His house would be a temple of pine, fit to entertain a traveling god. His vows were to meet the facts of life, the vital facts, the phenomena or actuality, the gods meant to show us face to face. His food would be a sacrament, a method of communion, a sitting at the communion table of the world. So Walden was going to be a religious book, but religious with a difference. Emerson had taught Thoreau all about the dead weight of all the old-fashioned Christian sermons that all around them were, in Emerson's words, clattering and echoing, unchallenged and unheard. Emerson, of course, had challenged them all in his divinity school address, where he told Harvard's graduating class that their God was dead and their Jesus just a man. Thoreau saw the storm that then came down on Emerson's head and stood by his friend. In turn, Emerson acknowledged Thoreau's support in his essay, Self-Reliance, where Emerson tells us, trust thyself. Thoreau was a son of Puritan New England, and he knew perfectly well that, as Emerson put it, self-reliance, the height and perfection of man, is reliance on God. It's just that Thoreau preferred to call on God by other names, happily drawing on other religious traditions, Buddhist, Hindu, Native American, even on Humboldt's sublime vision of cosmos, to imbue his universe with new meaning. Well, that form of resistance to convention got Thoreau labeled a heretic and an atheist. James Russell Lowell, at that time the cultural arbiter of all things good and proper, chided the young upstart that he'd been invited to enjoy a river party not to be preached at. Nature writing was not supposed to change your life. Thoreau never forgot that swat. In his first book, he had tried to prove that a river party was precisely the right place for a preacher, that attending truly to nature was the only way that would change your life. For Thoreau was facing a problem. How could he revive religious speech in America without triggering the wrath of convention? Walden was his next attempt. Here, instead of arguing with his elders, he tries changing the key, celebrating the presence of the sacred in the world all around us without invoking what he called in private that old Jewish scheme. He succeeded so well that generations of critics praise or blame him for giving us a whole new mode of addressing the sacred, as we say today, spiritual, but not religious. This started in Thoreau's own time. His friend Franklin Sanborn liked to tell how on his first Sunday in Concord, he asked directions to the local church. Which one? They all replied. The Unitarian, the Trinitarian, or the Church of Walden Pond. Sanborn declared for the latter, which is still going strong today. I suspect more than a few of us here tonight might count ourselves as members. So, two, why Walden? Okay, so Thoreau went to Walden to write a book, and while he was there, he discovered that he had a second book in him. But why was he there, really? In a word, Thoreau went to Walden to resurrect the dead. This was to be his journey of instauration, of metamorphosis, of renewal. There he was, a scholar who discovered that the books he loved were books no one read, a student of ancient languages that no one actually spoke. He'd fallen in love with natural science, too, not as an academic discipline, because Harvard hardly offered it as a course those days, but as a community of enthusiasts. It was Thoreau in his class of 1837 who founded Harvard's Natural History Society. But outside this tight cohort of friends, no one seemed to think that nature was worth a second look unless it was through the sights of a gun or while hefting an axe. Altogether, it seemed that Henry Thoreau lived among ghosts. His brother gone, a natural world vanishing, an expensive college education already obsolete. By the time Emerson gave him permission to build that tiny house on his land by the pond, Thoreau's career was dead too. All of them, actually. He'd been fired as a public school teacher, then forced to close his private school when his brother, who had helped him run it, grew too ill to help. He wanted to be a poet, but after Emerson's harsh criticism of his poetry, he burned most of his poems. He'd moved then to New York to make money as a writer, but he sold almost nothing there and returned home, his savings gone and his hopes ruined, to move back in with his parents to face a very disappointed Emerson who'd written him off, and resume his ignoble place as a factory hand in his father's pencil business. And then, to top it all off, the celebrated nature boy managed to burn down the woods. "Woods burner," his townsmen hissed at him as he passed. Even the nation seemed to be dying before his eyes. Thoreau was born and grew up in Concord, Massachusetts, the town that prided itself on sparking America's Revolutionary War. Thoreau and his generation, the sons and daughters of the Revolution, felt keenly that it was up to them to repair the mess led by a rash of world wars, to set the United States back on the path, the promise of liberty, equality, and prosperity. But the financial panic of 1837, which hit just as Thoreau was graduating and looking for a job, destroyed the nation's economy, taking with it the hopes of the working classes striving for a foothold in the American dream. Thoreau looked on as his own mentor, Orestes Bronson, turned into a socialist, publishing during the 1840 presidential election a rousing call, in his words, for the proletarian workers to rise up and overthrow capitalism. And Thoreau kept watching as the Democrats lost as a result of this essay, and Orestes Bronson took the blame for throwing the election. This was a harrowing experience that isolated and embittered Bronson, whose support of the free public education had meant a lot to Thoreau, that scholarship boy whose family nearly went broke putting him through Harvard. Worst of all, Thoreau watched as slavery tightened its grip on the nation's economy. Instead of leading the call to end slavery, New England's churches were closing their doors to all anti-slavery speakers. Well, Thoreau's mother and sisters and aunts had all joined the anti-slavery movement, and Henry Thoreau helped them bring abolitionist speakers to Concord. As he sat and listened to their rousing speeches, he asked himself what it was that he was called upon to do. For Thoreau refused merely to applaud someone else's speech, merely to join someone else's movement. He wanted to be a movement in himself, to embody the call to be a majority of one. He needed to find ground for a campaign of resistance. All this lay behind the moment on July 4th, 1845, when Thoreau set up housekeeping on Walden Pond and set about the task of meeting those facts of life face to face. Amidst all the national turmoil, he would pause. He would live in the most extreme simplicity so he could sort out what was real from all the sham and all the fake news. As he put it, "I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life and see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived, to drive life into a corner and reduce it to its lowest terms. And if it proved to be mean, why then go get the whole and genuine meanness of it and publish its meanness to the world? Or if it were sublime, to know it by experience and be able to give a true account of it in my next excursion." Two features mark this statement as uniquely Thoreau. First is his blunt emphasis on living his commitment at any cost, even if it meant driving life into a corner until the full truth came out. Whether life meant groveling in the dirt or singing with the angels, he wanted to know the truth for himself and publish it to the world. Second, abstract ideas had for Thoreau an embodied quality, a visceral quality, thoughts that the body thought, he called them. His theater of thought would not be up in Emerson's clouds, but down there in the woods, in a world of touch and smell, of sweat and splash, humus and wood smoke, away from the human community, yes, but also toward something else. Toward what, exactly? So recently, my friend, the transcendentalist scholar Dan Malachuk, has argued somewhat provocatively that Thoreau innovated on American political theory by separating democracy from individuality, asserting against mainstream liberal thought the right to two cities. One city, the profane world of society and politics, the other, the sacred world of spiritual growth. Ancient Christianity had called these two worlds the city of man and the city of God and asserted that they were equally real and equally central to human life, but that they existed in separate worlds bound in a tense but productive relationship. Even in Thoreau's day, this thinking was a minority view. America, then, was well on its way to constructing itself as a civil state founded on one nation under God, whose constitution was sealed not by mortal and fallible men, but by divine providence. One sees the tension in the Reverend William Ellery Channing, the Boston leader of the Unitarian Church, when watching the war cry come once again, he called for us to cultivate an individual moral conscience that would guide our resistance to profane and erring constitutional government, a two cities argument. That call, William Ellery Channing's call, helped Thoreau frame his own version of resistance to civil government in civil disobedience. And the famous words, "If the injustice is part of the necessary friction of the machine of government, let it go, perchance it will wear smooth, certainly the machine will wear out. But if it is of such a nature that it requires you to be the agent of injustice to another, then, I say, break the law. Let your life be a counter-friction to stop the machine." Thoreau's words gain their power from his own stance outside that same machine. And for Thoreau, that stance was literal, gained by living literally outside the city of men. But for most of his friends, that city of God was only a metaphor. I mean, you couldn't actually walk to heaven. Thoreau's great achievement was to give that metaphor a place and a name. Yeah, you could walk there. And he did every day. His pine-scented house became his port of access to the sacred, and while he treasured his long days and nights of solitude, he also welcomed visitors whom he introduced to the heaven right there at their elbow. For as Malachuk says, this doesn't mean that we're in the city of God always, but that it's never too far away. Our problem is that we don't take the time to ever visit this other place. Thoreau built not in some distant wilderness, but right at the edge of town. Remember the productive tension. You have to be right at the edge of town between the main road and the railroad tracks. Walden was the local fishing hole. It's where the kids hung out after school, and mothers took the family for picnics. Perhaps these are all, Thoreau mildly suggests, acts of communion, the mingling of humans and nature in a new and higher state. Or they could be if we only paid attention. After he moved back to town, rejoining his family in their Main Street home, he kept up connections by walking every day back out to this wild city of heaven, often with a friend or two, where he renewed his devotion and repeated his daily work of keeping the pathway between the profane and the sacred open and in good repair. That nature could be a site of principled civil resistance would seem more intuitive to us if we weren't so wed to divorcing humans and nature. The entire opening chapter of Walden is entitled, after all, Economy. What on earth, every student asks, they hate this chapter. What on earth is all this angry social polemic doing in a pretty book of nature writing? First off, it's there to get us to a point of resistance. Thoreau has to lead us through the city of man to show us exactly how and why its sins and shams call for another way of life. Second, economy doesn't mean just merely production and consumption, but the entire relationship between humans and nature. What we call now ecology, sort of split off as if it were a separate science, what we now split off as ecology was integral to Thoreau's concern about how to make a whole life, not just a living, under capitalism. Third, he must create the conditions to build his alternative city of heaven, calling us to pause in our relentless push to modernize and simplify our lives in resistance to its relentless consumerism. As for capitalism itself, Thoreau runs rings around it, playfully celebrating his life of leisure while mocking himself as the very modern model of an American entrepreneur, sinking all his capital in the business of life. Why, he suggests, doesn't everybody in America, even a penniless laborer squatting on someone else's land, have the freedom to make a life? Don't we all choose our destiny? Well, his unblinking depiction of what the American dream actually meant for the slaves, the freedmen, the Irish immigrants, and the poor whites who also lived at Walden, in what had been until just a few years before a rural slum, points us to the way Thoreau consciously paralleled his life with theirs, inviting us to imagine how, truth be told, we might all be in the same condition. We might all be on the wrong side of the tracks of capital. As he called out to the Irish laborers who were just then giving their lives to build the nation's railroads, quote, I wish, as you are brothers of mine, that you could have spent your time better than digging in this dirt. How does Walden come to life? When he was a young man buried in dead books and surrounded by dead poetry in which he could find no shred of the new world he lived in, Thoreau looked to the living world outside his windows and sighed, "Poetry cannot breathe in the scholar's atmosphere." One of the poems on his desk was Coleridge's Ode to Dejection, which prompted his motto to Walden, "I do not propose to write an ode to dejection." The nub of Coleridge's argument lies in his famous couplet, "O lady, we receive but what we give, and in our life alone does nature live." Thoreau refused to rewrite those lines. In the same way, he refused to follow Emerson, who said that the true poet is he who conforms things to his thoughts, not the other way around, who disposes of the world's material beings as mere symbols of the reality or the idea they exist to realize, classic idealism. By contrast, Thoreau found Emerson's world unlivable. As Thoreau protested, "May we not see God? Are we to be put off and amused in this life, as it were, with a mere allegory? Is not nature, rightly read, that of which she is commonly taken to be the symbol merely?" Of the philosophy spawned by dualism, Jonas thought idealism was just hopeless, for to it the world is dead, as it is dead to the world. He also thought that materialism, for all its limitations, was actually more interesting, for at least it encounters the living body with earnestness, knocking itself against the body's limitations and exposing itself to what Jonas called the real ontological test. When I read those words, I thought the echoes with Thoreau were haunting. Did he go to Walden as an ontological test? Did he go to Walden to settle for himself whether life was, in fact, not dead but alive? Whether he was living zombie-like in a world of illusions and projections, or whether phenomenal life had, as he put it to himself, actuality the gods meant to show us? Life. Who knows what it is, what it does? In his other famous statement of purpose, Thoreau declares that we must settle ourselves and work and wedge our feet downward through the mud and slush of opinion and prejudice and tradition and delusion and appearance, that alluvion which covers the globe, through Paris and London, through New York and Boston and Concord, through church and state, through poetry and philosophy and religion, till we come to a hard bottom and rocks in place, which we can call reality and say, "This is," and no mistake. This journey downward through all the projections to something he could imagine as tactile, the rock on which to build that heaven, becomes the plot of Walden. That's why Walden is a journey downward, not to heavens, but to the earth, earthbound. It's a very peculiar task, and it does make for a very peculiar book. It has to somehow capture us as a kind of fictional narrative, a kind of hero's journey. But it must also bind us, author and readers, together in the face of the indisputable framework for existence, the very earth itself. Does it make sense, then, that the man who wrote this in a book starts his journey of resurrection not with the self, not with nature, not even with the earth, but with books? This is not the place for a reading of Walden, which I will not attempt, but I'll offer a couple of points. In his early chapter entitled Reading, Thoreau stretches his earlier statement of purpose by adding that just as life must be lived deliberately, so must books be read as deliberately and reservedly as they were written. Well, this would mean if we took him literally taking about 9 years to read Walden, and maybe we'd have time to read about 4 more books in the course of a human lifetime. But since Thoreau is a voracious reader, he must have meant something else. He starts with the most basic unit. The written word, he suggests, is the work of art nearest to life itself, because it may be actually breathed from all human lips, carved out of the breath of life itself, he writes. The secret of reading well, then, is to enter and inhabit the words, not merely intellectually, but physically, like I'm doing in my breath and my hands, right? To breathe them aloud and feel in them the literal breath of life, breathed into them by the author. Not the mind, but the body gives them life. Of course, he's giving us instructions for how he wants to be read, with all your life's breath, as if your life depended on it. His certainly does. Only as we breathe his words into life does he, Henry Thoreau, continue to live. We are, in other words, to read as if we too were writers, whose very survival depends on those same stringent conditions of futurity, of somebody around to read later what we are writing now. This is his first answer to Coleridge. In our life alone, do books live? Implied here is a tremendous responsibility. What we fail to read dies. Do we make these life and death decisions consciously, deliberately? It's the least any author could ask, and it's what he asks of us. If you're with me so far, Thoreau's next chapter, Sounds, will make perfect sense, because from the breath of life in the written word, he moves to what he calls the language which all things and events speak. While the written word comes alive as it is read, most of our great literature, he says, isn't written at all. As he adds, much is published but little printed. And it's one of those Thoreauvian things. It takes you a minute to figure out what he's saying. What this chapter tells us isn't just about sounds, but the surround of the world. How he sits for hours meditating, just soaking it all up. How he cleans his house. What plants grow along the path to the pond. And yes, how the tantivy of the wild pigeons gives a voice to the air, and how the screams and rattles of the locomotive across the pond gives a voice to industrial modernity. It's all common as dirt, which is his point. This is the speech of the world, an oral literature that dies in the utterance, and it cannot live beyond the moment. Kill those pigeons, and the voice of the air dies too. The tension lies in the vibrations along all the many layers of sound and all the beings that they express. Dogs barking, carts rattling on the road, sheep bleeding on the rail cars carrying them to market, the lowing of cows and the hooting of owls. To us, all this is silent. For while his words can find us here, we cannot follow him back there. He wants his page to be bigger than the page, though, big enough to hold us, too. So he conjures a world out of sound to give us a world in common. Our life, his life, defined as alive by the literal vibrations in the ambient air, a throbbing pulse which penetrates our bodies as well as his, and does away, as he insists at the end, with normal boundaries altogether. No yard, he cries, but unfenced nature reaching up to your very sills. So this initiates the double movement from the pen scratching the paper, one movement out to us, reading the same words he wrote, but carried by the materiality of ink and paper or electrons on a screen. Then a second movement from the pen scratching the page back out to those dogs and carts and sheep and rail cars, the cows and owls and pigeons and all of it, the world, which doesn't face him as some monolithic nature or object to be somehow copied into a subjective representation, but as chains of reference referred back to his written page by his acts as a writer who walks, notebook in hand, across the woods and across the streets, bringing things back. Scrawls on bits of paper, notes from books, pine cones and chunks of limestone, water to mix his ink with. A double delegation, on the one side out to his world and back, and on the other out to us, our world, where he hopes his words will capture our breath, and our life alone will his world live. Now, how does any book come to life? By bringing a world to life, and by so doing, bringing our world back to life. Thoreau's resurrection is meant to be our own. To see this, it helps to set aside our familiar divide and remember how works of literature can really create characters who feel and are wholly real to us, even as we know they're fiction. So Walden may be nonfiction, but Thoreau crafted it to engage us, to capture us as a work of fiction, that hero's journey. It's the vibration between fiction and reality that makes it come alive and also makes that life insinuate itself into us as believable, as real life, something that demands our commitment. So there is the actual pond. I've been there, probably you too. And there's the book by the same name. And then there's the one Thoreau, the one who held the pen, who now molders in a grave, and that other one, the author, the I, who lives on in this book. This book, Walden authorizes us in turn, even incites us into arguing, into authoring our own responses to it. Of course, we'll all come to 1,000 different interpretations of it, but that we get so passionate about this book shows how real it's become to us. Walden, that is a being of fiction, in Bruno Latour's term. It's a work of art that engages us. It lures us into thinking and feeling. But we can't just say just anything we want about it. There are limits which the work of art itself imposes. That is, art makes us subject to its meaning. Well, maybe you don't love it at all. Maybe you hate it. That's okay. Someone who does not feel held and engendered by what the work of art requires will never be inhabited by it. And Thoreau is okay with that. He just asks us one thing: accept what applies to you. But please, if my book doesn't fit you, don't tear it apart. Don't ruin it for the others. As he writes, I trust that none will stretch the seams in putting on the coat, for it may do good service to those whom it fits. Fortunately, Walden has proven large and manifold enough to sustain a growing community of readers, amateur and professional, an author society, a dedicated academic journal across many decades, with no sign of slowing down. This lecture tonight, and all of you are now part of Walden's great instauration. But there's one more feature of Walden's legacy that really intrigues me. Yes, as a work of literature, it insists on its fictive power to enchant us, to carry us into its world so that we carry Walden forward into our world. But something else, too. It also insists on its factive power, on the fact that this is a real person and a real place. This has risks. We'll fault Thoreau if his science is wrong. We'll blame him. If we suspect he's not being honest with us, generations of hostile readers have discredited the fictive Thoreau because the actual factive Thoreau ate Sunday dinners with his family. Nobody thinks to make charges like this against Emerson or against Edgar Allan Poe or Jonathan Franzen. That is, Walden asks us to accept it as an aesthetic being, to enjoy its beauty as a work of art, and also to accept the world that it gathers and illuminates as a real and complete world. That means it's not just his world, but also ours, one that we can visit and treasure. Walden, then, needs our care and our solicitude. Without us, without readers, it will disappear. Of course, there'll still be a pond, but it won't be the commons that it is today, freely open to all because of the strange way that this work of literature can make us want to hold it so that it can keep holding us together. But this leads to another insight. Just as Walden is not a single creation, a book issued once in 1854 and needing nothing more from any of us, So too, it is a continuous act of creation, one that does need us if it is to continue through time. This is Thoreau's own philosophy of life, as he declared when still simmering from reading Darwin's Origin of Species, when he wrote that the theory of evolution rang true because it implies a greater vital force in nature, equivalent to a sort of constant new creation. Darwin engaged Thoreau in his own Darwin's new instauration. They both together would combat the old sense of creation as a singular act long ago that needed nothing more from us. They both would insist instead that creation is a constant process, a sublime engendering going on all around us all the time, an engendering that has never not been a part of us, part of who we are. Thoreau sees himself implicated in Darwin's work, engaged in it. He's got to be present in his reading to Darwin, too, just as in Walden, he must be present to the sunrise. As Thoreau said in the climax of Walden, watching the spring sun melt the frozen soil, the earth is not a mere fragment of dead history, stratum upon stratum, like the leaves of a book to be studied by geologists and antiquarians, chiefly, but living poetry like the leaves of a tree, not a fossil earth, but a living earth. The resurrection, then, was complete. Walden was dead and is alive again. In this, Thoreau reveals himself as one of America's closest students, of Alexander von Humboldt, my other great love, whose best-selling work, Cosmos, offered a proto-evolutionary vision of the physical universe as a constant self-making creation that the human imagination organizes into a cosmos as we become part of that part of cosmos which can look upon the universe and see it as the ancient Greek word held, as ordered and as beautiful. Humboldt's great argument was that we are charged with the responsibility to sustain that ongoing creation. For while the physical universe doesn't really need us, it existed before us, will go on existing after us. The cosmos, as the Greeks recognized in their wisdom, cannot exist without us. Like Walden, Thoreau's response to Humboldt's cosmos solicits us, engages us, needs us to republish it in our words and be part of its continuous journey of creation. That journey is nothing less than the narrative that we are co-authoring with the material reality that we are, the same reality that through us found its way to consciousness, to speech, to writing, to culture, to the growth and cultivation of the cosmos that was and is to come. The tragedy is that this thinking failed. A modernizing globe had no wish to slow down the pace of capital accumulation merely because a couple of literary scientists in love with the earth used art to show us that we're not stuck on the surface like some bugs pinned to a museum display, but inescapably part of its integral ecology. And this is what's at stake in the Anthropocene, our soul and our humanity. For our world is not given to us, but like Walden, it is anthropogenic. It holds together and holds us together exactly insofar as we take responsibility for its continued journey, its continued instauration. If we refuse that responsibility, if we default on it, Thoreau fears that we'll lose not Earth. He couldn't imagine that. Not civilization, which to him was already a little suspect, but ourselves, all the trajectories, all the many instaurations that hold us together in all the ways that we are held. As Thoreau punned in a week, I presume that there is not less religion than formerly. If the ligature is found to be loosened in one part, it's only drawn the tighter in another. So the man who risked his career to loosen the ligatures of the Orthodox Christianity of his day hardly meant to free us from all the bonds that hold together the cosmos that upholds us. Rather, he meant to direct our attention earthward to the terrestrial bonds that we need in modernity's new world. This was his ontological test. Can we love the multiplicity of the world enough to be engendered together by the work it requires to sustain it? Walden was dead and is alive again. That means that Coleridge was wrong. In nature's life alone do we live. Thus, Thoreau's legacy is that he asks us to look down, earthward, earthbound. Thoreau urges us to remember that transcendence is under our feet as well as over our heads. For it turns out astonishingly that in our world of global climate change, we're all needing to become transcendentalists now, compelled to register the intrusion of these transcendent forces upon our ordinary world, lest we drown in rising tides or burn in the wildfires that are consuming the forests of my own home in the Pacific Northwest. It seems we must continue to hold Thoreau in our thoughts. It seems he has not yet finished engendering us. Indeed, if the dawn he anticipates is to come, if our thinking is to open new possibilities for the future, then we are all the more responsible for asking of Thoreau and his friends our hardest questions, pressing upon these ghosts from our past, our deepest forebodings of the future they helped prepare, that we may prepare now as the ghosts of the future for those who will follow us. For in our lives alone will the future live. That's it. Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Laura Walls, professor of English at the University of Notre Dame. Professor Walls' lecture was titled Henry David Thoreau's Legacy of Resistance and Hope and was presented by the Boston University College of Arts and Sciences. Tonight's moderators were Boston University Professor of Biology Richard Primack and Professor of English Adriana Krakun. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Lee Shuna and Maximilian Arthur Liebman. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Leidotes. I'm Jack Lepiars. Thanks for joining us.